This is the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 23rd, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and by Kaplan Financial Education. I'm Ed Zollers, bringing this to you this week again from here in Phoenix, Arizona, where it's not quite as toasty as it has been, but we're still going to be sitting in the upper 80s today. So, warm day, shall we say. This week, though, we're going to look at the following topics. First, we're going to look at a pair of rulings the IRS brought out late on Wednesday that deal with the deduction of Paycheck Protection Program expenses if a taxpayer had not yet received their forgiveness by the date that the year ends. And we'll talk about that. It's not unexpected. The guidance is very much as we discussed previously, what the AICPA had suggested would be coming. But we'll also discover, again, talk about maybe some alternative views on this. As well, the IRS put together a second revenue procedure that deals with the problem of what if you follow the IRS ruling and then discovered that your reasonable expectation of forgiveness turned out to be in error. And the IRS will give you some options there. Also this week, we got the publication of the instructions for this Form 1120S, which includes some additional information beyond this year's Schedule K-1 for the 1120S related to number of shares held by the shareholders beginning end of year and loans outstanding from the shareholder to the company beginning and end of year. The IRS commissioner at the AICPA National Conference on Federal Taxes specifically declined to give the AICPA the requested relief for general purpose relief to taxpayers for late filing and late payment, the commissioner putting a very solid no on that request at the conference, and we'll discuss what that means. We're also discussing about late filing. A taxpayer who attempted to argue for reasonable cause for late filing their return when their CPA submitted the return what appears to be seconds late following the October 15th deadline passing, and why the court decided that A, that doesn't work regardless, and B, even if we could rely on a third party to file a return for us, it has to be a reasonable reliance, and why in this case history would have suggested that there was no such thing as a reasonable reliance in this case. Finally, the IRS updated their FAQ on the employee retention credit, looking at the issues that happen when an employer who plans to claim the employee retention credit acquires either the equity or the assets of another employer that had received a Paycheck Protection Program loan, and what impact that has on the acquiring employer for purposes of being able to claim the employee retention credit. But let's start out with that IRS ruling that we had discussed we believed was coming a week ago, and this week that ruling came out. This is Revenue Ruling 2020-27. The ruling was released on November the 18th of 2020. As we discussed last week, the AICPA had telegraphed this ruling at numerous locations, including, as I mentioned, the Washington Pacific Tax Conference that I was presenting on and that Ed Carl of the AICPA presented just ahead of me, where he essentially told us this was coming. And it's pretty much in line with what the AICPA had suggested. Under the IRS ruling, a taxpayer may not claim a deduction for expenses that can be used for getting forgiveness from their Paycheck Protection Program loan if the taxpayer has a reasonable expectation of forgiveness based on those expenses, even if forgiveness has not been granted yet by the end of the tax year, or potentially even by the time the taxpayer is looking to file the return. Now, as we discussed last week, this is somewhat controversial. Certainly, there are a lot of people that disagree with the issue. As we discussed last week, you know, this is the IRS's prime basis now is tied to, and I should say, expected reimbursement. We discussed last week why that was crucial. You know, previously we had this issue where if the IRS was looking to, when they actually came up with the initial ruling, 2020-32, the IRS had said, well, the problem here is you have tax-exempt income based on the forgiveness, and that tax-exempt income, if you pay for expenses out of tax-exempt income, then the deduction must be disallowed. Then the minor paragraph at the very end. It's the next to last paragraph of Notice 2020-32. It's a very short one. They spent a lot of time discussing and defending their theory of the tax-exempt income 265A1 denial of deduction. But they did just before the section that tells you who you can contact at the IRS if you have questions about this particular notice. They told us, and by the way, well, really, this represents a reimbursement of expenses. And if your expense is being or will be reimbursed, obviously you cannot deduct it. And they cited a couple of cases there. But their primary theory in the notice was clearly the tax-exempt income status. In fact, that goes back to even the Treasury Secretary's comments, his infamous Tax 101 comment that appeared to upset the Tax Writing Committee, at least three of the four senior members of the Tax Writing Committees, presenting a new letter back. Well, at this point now, the IRS has switched over. And in this particular revenue ruling, they rely far more on the relief, on the fact that you have an expectation of reimbursement of the expense, and that denies the deduction. The reason for this swap is pretty obvious, to be honest. A reasonable expectation of reimbursement would deny the deduction based on case law, even if you had not already received that reimbursement. For instance, think about the case back when we could deduct employee business expenses. If your client came in and they had paid these expenses related to their employment, but you discovered that they could have submitted those expenses for reimbursement under the employer's expense account, but for whatever reason had decided not to do it, that was tough luck. You know, you're not going to be able to claim a deduction and have the feds do a partial subsidy if the expense could have been reimbursed by your employer. And so the same problem would come here. Now, the problem, of course, is why now that becomes important is we get down to the theory of Bliss Dairy. And Bliss Dairy's theory, we talked about that, was the fact that there, as we discussed last week, the steps there were that we claimed the deduction in the case of Bliss Dairy in the year it would normally be allowed under normal rules. Then when an event in the following year that was inconsistent with the deduction was claimed, that's when we had the recapture. And what that would mean is, if you follow this event, and it certainly appears now with income, this is not reimbursement, so it does appear this is much, much, much more like Bliss Dairy, if it's not a reimbursement structure, that we should get the deduction for the year ended, let's say December 31st, 2020, if we had not yet applied for and received a forgiveness notice from the SBA. And then in 2021, when the SBA does finally tell us, hey, here's your forgiveness amount, then we would recapture a portion of that prior year's deduction under the tax benefit rule, consistent with Bliss Dairy, and to be totally honest, consistent with the position the IRS advanced in Bliss Dairy. So it's kind of interesting, and certainly I think it's one of those things we're going to have to pay some attention to. Now, that said, if you read my write-up about this week, I make one thing very clear. Clients have to understand, if you're going to go the Bliss Dairy route, clients have to understand that it's highly unlikely that the IRS would give in on this issue because we now have a revenue ruling from the national office. An agent is basically not going to give in on this issue. And I doubt the appellate conferees will unless the IRS has already lost a number of cases on the issue by the time your case gets to appeals. So your client, realistically, if they're going to carry this, if they are challenged, they would have to go to tax court. Tax court is not cheap to go to. You know, it certainly costs real money in terms of legal fees to mount a tax court case. Even if your client wins, it is not very likely that the IRS will be, you know, you'll be awarded fees from the IRS on this issue. That we will see, you know, the courts aren't likely to do that. Even when they do that, the fees awarded are rarely the fees your attorney charged you. And so bottom line is, it may very well be, does it not cost effective? Now, even if your client decides they don't want to go to tax court, there's still the problem of they get in the middle of an exam. They need to have you come in and represent them. And even if they're just going to roll over and play dead and take the tax assessment, now the IRS comes back and says penalties, and we have to spend some time fighting that. Obviously, an A275 could help get rid of those penalties if we file that with return, but then, of course, you've disclosed the issue, and if the IRS is looking for this on A275, your client may be concerned that that would cause the IRS to look at their return. And let's be honest, if the IRS is looking at their return anyway, they might as well look at other things. So it raises this whole mess of getting embroiled deep in an exam for what's going to be effectively a timing difference. And to be totally honest, the other thing is, we had right after this came out, the day after this came out, basically Senator Grassley, who currently chairs Senate Finance, and Senator Wyden, who is currently the ranking Democratic member of Senate Finance, they repeated their complaint to the Treasury in a joint statement, basically stating that they still believe that this is a totally wrong view of Treasury, that these things should be allowed as a deduction. They again asked Treasury to reconsider. I think that ask is going to fall on deaf ears, but they are repeating it. And most likely, though, it does indicate, especially since we know that Representative Neal also is, you know, opposed to the denial of deduction and has draft legislation. And we know that Senator Thune, who is in the Republican leadership, is also on Senate Finance and is one of the co-sponsors along with Senators Wyden and Grassley, the chair of this provision of a bill to reverse this decision. There's a decent chance we'll see this pass. The real problem is when, and the catch is if Congress does pass it, good news, bad news, it will moot the point. That also means, though, that your client may very well need to go past the end of this year not knowing the status of the deduction. And the other side effect is they may also need to go on extension for a while until Congress finally gets around to dealing with this issue, because currently, certainly, we've yet to see them really move on funding the government by December 11th. And certainly, while it might get attached there, the longer that waits, the more higher the chance it will be a totally clean bill. That is, they will not try to deal with anything else whenever they manage to pass it before or after December 11th. So essentially, you know, we're looking at a very, very good chance that this will not be picked up until sometime in the new Congress, very probably until after a new president is brought in. And yeah, so this could all be delayed into February, March, whenever Congress feels the need to go back and touch on this, depending upon what the state of politics are at that point. So if you can figure that out, you're way better than I am. In any event, be aware we may have that issue coming up. Now, the other part of this was the IRS issued a related revenue procedure 2020-51, also on the 18th. Actually, was in the early evening Eastern time that they released it. And what this procedure does is talks about kind of now the obvious problem. So I have these expenses I paid in 2020. I had not applied for forgiveness. I go ahead and said, yeah, I think I'm getting full forgiveness. So I disallowed the expenses that would lead, you know, an amount equal to the expenses that would be given to me if I got full forgiveness. Then we discover in 2020 that our bank or the SBA comes back and says, no. You don't get full forgiveness for A, B, C, D, whatever reason. We are not going to allow you to claim a deduction for full forgiveness of the loan. And based on that, we essentially now have this disallowed, the amount we're going to have to pay back to the loan. How do we handle that situation? You know, how exactly do we deal with this? And the IRS says, well, if either of two conditions apply, we're going to give you some options. So first, if either some or all of the amount that you had expected to be forgiven is denied on the application, or you just, after the beginning of the year, decide not to apply. You expected to apply before, but maybe now you've studied the guidance and you've determined that you're not going to qualify, so you decide not to apply for forgiveness, or presumably apply for less forgiveness than you had originally intended to. So for whatever reason, we're not going to get the forgiveness we'd intended to get. If that happens, the IRS gives you two options. Now, these options are open in either case, although they do tell us which one works if you don't go this revenue procedure in the case of the denial. They don't really tell us what would happen if you changed your mind. I think they're concerned there may be an ability to play games, not necessarily here, but in other cases. So they're not going to comment on where you're under control and just decide not to do something. Like I say, I don't think it's for this because clearly you have two options here. You could use either one. I don't think they want to rule which way it would go if you don't use the revenue procedure because of concerns that if they give the same answer they're giving for when it's denied, that people might game the system in other areas based on reliance on this. So what are our options? Well, the options are pretty simple. We either could claim the amount in question. Let's say we can go back and we can revise the return we filed where we didn't take the deduction because we expected, you know, there to be forgiveness. When that didn't happen, we could go back and revise that return. Okay, and if you want to do that, that's fine. The IRS will not object to it. Now, that's a little unusual because, as I think we've discussed here before, as I've discussed this issue before, generally, you know, we don't care about things that aren't known or knowable at year end. And since you reasonably expected that you would get forgiveness, presumably we're going to consider it's not knowable. You certainly didn't know, and you were had a reasonable expectation. You didn't know that there would not be full forgiveness. So because of that, it would seem like theoretically this should be deducted in the following year. But they're going to give you the option to go back and amend, and that could be helpful. A couple of reasons. First thing is it's always possible that 2020 could have been a better year than 21 is going to be. Okay, that probably not going to be true for some businesses, but it is for others. There definitely are businesses that are benefiting from this. I mean, we hear a lot in COVID about those that are hammered, and yeah, they're hammered badly. But there are certain businesses that have done very well. I could say Zoom, for instance, has done very well based on this. So there are certain specific types of businesses that are doing much better, or at least, you know, have not done way worse because of this. So we'll, you know, we have to remember that. So it might be useful there. But let's say we did do badly in 2020. Well, then we got a flip side of this. 2020, we have NOLs. If NOLs created in 2020, that net operating loss can be carried back 5 years, and there is no cap on the percentage of that NOL that can be used to offset taxable income. If that deduction goes into 21, and let's assume 21 is still a bad year, because at least based upon what we know right now, even with vaccines, you know, it appears those vaccines, I was listening to the former FDA commissioner this morning, who sits on the board of Pfizer, and his timeline was an expectation that you'll finally get this vaccine out to the general public and not just specialized groups, probably second quarter, middle of next year, even maybe third quarter. So if you're a business where you're having trouble getting people to show up because they are just COVID nervous, and so you're having trouble getting things back up to where they were before, that problem seems like could continue to occur until, you know, midway through next year, more than midway through next year. So next year could still be a bad year for you and you could generate a loss. But obviously that 21 loss, since it doesn't go back and it will be limited, capped at 80% offset of taxable income going forward under the law that we have now, you know, we might prefer it in 2020. So we have that option. Alternatively, you can take the deduction on the 21 return. So the IRS will let you choose between the two. Now, the IRS does tell us if you do not take the safe harbor and it is the bank or the SBA that causes you to get less forgiveness than you had expected, that this would be the year you would claim it, even if you don't go under the safe harbor. It would be picked up on the 21 return. And I say 21, realistically, it would be the return for the year in which you finally determine how much you're not going to get. Could go into a different tax year. I'm going to say 20 and 21 because that's going to be most cases we're looking at. But conceivably, whatever year that determination is made. So your options are go back to amend the return you didn't deduct it on, or go ahead and claim it is a deduction now in the year in which you get that determination, the final determination that you're not getting the full amount of forgiveness that you had reasonably expected when you prepared your return. Now, the other thing to have, if you're going to use this RevProc, there are requirements for a statement that has a lot of detailed information that needs to be attached to the return. So if you do plan to use this, you want to keep track of that and keep track of the statement. Your tax software may automate this or it may not. Tax software is kind of hit and miss for things like this. And we won't really probably know how it's going to handle it until we see 21 returns. I guess they will have to start doing it on 20 returns, but 20 fiscal year returns, because you might have had a 19 fiscal year return, right, that ended in 20. And that's going to then have a fiscal year 20 return that will end in 21. And conceivably, that could be when you have the swap over. So you may want to check your software to see if they're adding this or not. But if not, you need to draft up the statement that will be attached to the return as a, you know, at worst case, a PDF attachment. And you'll attach that to the return. But be ready for that for your clients going down this route. Again, as I noted, this is kind of a, and I should say, this is really a reverse of tax benefit, right? Under the tax benefit concept, you would claim the deduction and then in the following year pick up the benefit. Now what they're saying is deny the deduction initially, and oh, in later years, if it turns out you have to pay, you could take the deduction with this little caveat that we'll let you throw back into 20 if you want to. So, you know, be aware of that little quirk and how we do it. Next, the IRS published the instructions for Form 1120S in draft form on the 17th, and we have a couple of new things added to Schedule K-1. And this draft K-1 came out in, as I recall, it came out in July or August, I think. The K-1, I believe, came out in July, and the draft 1120S came out in August, but now we have the instructions to go with. And pretty much these boxes are what you think they are, but they do have some additional explanation. First thing is, for every shareholder, you're going to have to put in new item G, the shares of stock they held at the beginning of the year, the shares of stock they held at the end of the year. And obviously, if that number does not change, and that number doesn't change for any shareholder, this is going to enable the IRS to do a very quick calculation to see if it appears that somebody is doing something weird on allocating income. Remember, S corporation income allocations are per share, per day, by default. And if we haven't had any changes in ownership, or if we did and didn't make an election, basically, or let's say with no change in ownership, that's a simple case. The IRS should be able to take Schedule K from the 1120S and figure out what everybody's K-1 should show. And if your K-1 doesn't show what it should by looking at Schedule K and your percentage of the shares outstanding during the year, they may have some questions. It also can allow them to spot cases where there should be something on Schedule D for a sale or disposition of the shares because your number of shares went down, you know, and others didn't. So it looks like, yeah, probably there was a sale. So certainly they have some information they're going to get from that on the K-1 that could help them in picking returns for exam or could help the agent in an exam. The other item is going to be item H, and that's going to ask for your beginning and end of year loans from shareholder. And in this case, in the instructions, they want to make clear something here too. Just to clarify, guys, in case you didn't remember this, because the case law has been very, very clear on this. The loans from shareholders do not include any loan that the shareholder has merely guaranteed that the S corporation took out. They don't count in that category. And neither do loans where the shareholder and the S corp are co-makers of the loan. You know, so there's a joint liability. Has to be a loan from the shareholder to the S corp. Now, you can structure, and we've had winning cases that we can see in the past from the tax court, where you can structure deals where the bank loans money to the shareholder, and the shareholder then turns around and loans money to the S corp, even using, you know, dedicated accounts that money has to go in and out through, where when the money's loaned to the shareholder, it goes to an account where the only place it can go from there is to the S corp. and vice versa. When the S corp pays back the shareholder, the money goes back into that same account where it is immediately transferred back to the bank. I mean, those structures have worked, but it's really important to understand you have to get the form right. And they're reminding you about that in this case. They don't want to see anything in box 8 or in item H that represents either a guarantee or co-maker obligation, because those don't count. It also has one of the first detailed discussions of the fact that you better not be deducting those PPP loan expenses on your 1120S. We also got this week, very late in the week, the draft instructions for the regular old 1120 corporate return, and the same, you know, kind of admonition is found there. So be aware, the IRS is going to keep reminding you, don't deduct those PPP loan expenses, those items you expect to use to get forgiveness on the PPP loan. They're going to keep reminding you of that little detail. Okay, next up, we have here in the next slide, the IRS commissioner this week spoke at the AICPA's National Conference on Federal Taxes. And in Tax Notes Today Federal, published on the 18th, William Hoffman had an article which is entitled very simply, "Reddick to Tax Pros, Blanket Penalty Relief Not Going to Happen." The AICPA had been writing on a few occasions this year to the IRS, pleading for some sort of blanket level of relief for late filing and late payment, noting that a lot of taxpayers and a lot of preparers, due to COVID, were subject to situations where it became very difficult for the taxpayer or the preparer to be able to properly complete all forms on time. Now, I will say honestly, in our practice, we saw none of that. But then again, you know, we were certainly able to convert over to whatever had to be done outside the office we'd done, because people had been doing that before. It wasn't anything new for us. I do know that some CPAs who had never done that, who had never even thought about doing it, really got into some big problems there trying to work around this, especially if COVID became bad in their area. And they kind of lost their comfort with being down at the office, but then also couldn't figure out how to make the remote stuff work. I understand that it was there. So the AICPA asked, and certainly some clients had trouble. You know, you might have had clients who were in, you know, facilities that were for, you know, the elderly, and many of those locked down, even facilities that were just kind of, you know, general purpose assisted living, and they're kind of places where people live. And if they end up needing assistance, it's there. So it's kind of bundled in, but a lot of them, you know, are very mobile, very able to go out and about, but they were restricted at that point because of concerns for the more vulnerable in the group. And so that caused a problem with them getting information to the CPA, and vice versa, the CPA being able to get their sign forms back. So the AICPA requested some form of generous relief. The commissioner, as the title of the article says basically, it's not going to happen. We're not going to do that. Now, there are quotes in the article from Ed Carl of the AICPA, who we mentioned before last week, and I mentioned this week, you know, indicating that they don't believe this is reasonable. They don't understand why they don't want to do it. The commissioner says, well, if you were in my shoes, you'd understand. The AICPA says, we know you don't want to benefit people who really have just been reckless, but, you know, if in any year you were going to kind of bias toward being taxpayer friendly, this seems to be it. Bottom line, though, it does not appear the current commissioner is likely to change, and his term doesn't end until 2022. Yes, he did testify before the House this week, and he did indicate that if a new president decides that they don't want him in the position, that he wouldn't really fight it, but he has no plans otherwise to leave. And by the way, that was very similar 4 years ago when the then commissioner had time left on his term. And again, you know, it was the same issue. There was a lot of speculation that he was going to be let go early, but, you know, and then finally we did get a let go, as I recall. But yeah, we're in that sort of mix. So we'll see what's going to happen. But honestly, we've not heard anything yet that suggests that the new president would actually, the president-elect plans to get rid of the IRS commissioner. And we may know more once we know who the new president plans to appoint as Treasury Secretary. And the president-elect has suggested that he will announce that somewhere in the next week or so. So we might start hearing things then because we'll have a new Treasury Secretary who might be asked about these things, but we'll have to see. What the IRS Commissioner tells us right now, Commissioner Rettig, is that you should be going on a case-by-case basis. If there actually is that problem where you have that person who is in the facility and they weren't allowed to leave, you know, because if they left and they got exposed and came back, it put the real vulnerable people at risk, and people weren't really generally allowed to go in, and it was difficult getting forms signed because maybe they're a, you know, they're an older client who's not really into tech stuff, and you know, and they're used to having you there and showing where to sign and talking about the return, and we all understand how that would work. Well, if those are the type of situations, then in theory, you can call up and hopefully try to plead your case for relief. But if you are looking for some sort of general relief provision this year, pretty much the commissioner says, forget about it. Not happening. Next up, talking about not getting relief from penalties, this is PATA versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2020-154. And again, this was November 16th, 2020, when this one came down. And what we're looking at here is going to be an issue of a taxpayer where a CPA, in this case, created a return at 11:59 p.m. on October 15th of the year in question. Now, as you might guess, that's a little late in the day. And not surprisingly, you know, because like most of our tax software, we create a file for electronic filing right, and then what we have to do is we have to go in and separately ask our system to submit that to the IRS. And obviously, the problem becomes that, you know, there's going to be some time passage there. And when it finally got shipped up to the IRS, it shipped up at just after midnight. So we are talking about a submission that was seconds late, right? So we have a seconds late submission. Well, the taxpayers argued that, well, you know, we should have reasonable cause. We definitely tried to get filed on time. It was ready to be filed on time. It actually was done at that instant in time. So it was done prior to the deadline. And the only thing that happened was the CPA didn't manage to get it submitted timely. And look, we can't e-file returns, so we couldn't submit it. So we think we should have reasonable cause for late filing and the penalty should not apply. Well, the court didn't buy that. And the court goes back to our old friend, the case, the Boyle case. And we discussed Boyle recently on another, you know, forgiveness for being unable to, for, you know, for the fact the CPA in that case didn't get extensions filed. In this case, now we're looking at Boyle again. And the court says, well, based on Boyle, it doesn't matter. This is a non-delegable duty to make sure the documents are filed on time. You know, you should have done something more to verify that those documents would be handled timely or taken steps to get it fixed. You can't just rely on the CPA getting it done. So tough luck, guys, we're there. Now that might seem harsh, and frankly it does, because honestly, the client had to have signed the authorization, we would presume, right? And, you know, at that point in time, and I guess regenerated, that may have been and very possibly was to put the client's signature dates in there finally, officially, and send it in. You know, so realistically, like, yeah, you know, being a little tough here. Well, you might remember when we talked about the previous case, we had mentioned the fact that for 1 year, the attorney had gotten out of late filing penalties due to the first-time abatement program. And you might start wondering, well, why isn't this one working for FTA? Well, therein lies the problem. The court said even if it was reasonable to have an agent file something for you, you would still have to take, you know, you still have to make sure that that was reasonable for you to do that. And so even if you could reasonably assign it to the agent, the court points out that you had been using this firm for the past 3 years. And you had never managed to get the return filed on time with this firm in the past 3 years. So presumably, said, I don't know, you know, and the court didn't say if it was the firm's fault or their fault, but the, you know, said, but certainly we had never had a demonstration that this firm would get it filed on time. Again, I think that's probably being a little too picky on the CPA firm, but nevertheless, that's where they went. They're saying, so your reliance would not have been reasonable because you had no evidence that this would be taken care of timely by this particular professional And in fact, it wasn't, right? They were going that late. So yeah, it's kind of a mess there. Again, remember, don't forget, the reason I bring these up is you're not going to be able to get relief from the IRS for late filing or similar items based on problems the CPA had. At least 99 times out of 100, that's not going to work. They're going to come back to boil right away. This doesn't mean that your local court, when the client sues you for damages, will not find it was your fault and will not force you to pay the penalties. So this is kind of a really bad result for the CPA firm, even if it seems technically it's a bad result for the client, because I guarantee you there's going to be a claim coming. So as I say, kind of an interesting mess. Be aware of that, that getting these things filed on time is really important. The other catch is, man, you know, you need to have a cutoff. If you're down at the office finishing returns at 11:59 p.m. on October 15th, you got an issue with controlling your clients and telling clients when things have to be in and done. Either that or you're one heck of a procrastinator. Assuming it wasn't that, I mean, you know, you got to have a little better client control than that, because allowing it to go this far means that this minor hiccup, for whatever reason, why you couldn't get it done, and you almost have to assume that either we were really working up the last second, or we had a bunch of returns we're trying to do that, you know, so we may, and probably, you know, if you let one client do this, you're probably letting others do it. You know, it's like, you know, you got, you know, the firm got itself backed into a corner on this one, it would appear. Seems likely, and now they're going to have a little fun, unfortunately, with that exposure. Finally, we're going to talk about the IRS has posted some revisions on their website on November 16th for the Employee Retention Credit. You may remember that credit, right? It's a credit that we get if we didn't take out a Paycheck Protection Program loan, and we either pay people when they're not working for us, right? That's for any size employer, because we were shut down due to COVID. Or, you know, we've had a major drop in revenue, and again, we're paying people who don't work for us. Or if we're 100 employees or less, we're paying anybody in either of those cases, whether they're doing work for us or not at the time. So it can be useful if you didn't get the Paycheck Protection Program loan. And by the way, you know, the stats we've seen from the GAO suggest that probably 80% of eligible businesses did not get a PPP loan. 80% of what would be considered the general small business group that would theoretically be eligible for PPP loans, or at least could be eligible if they showed the need. We get into that whole $2 million show the need routine. You know, there are a chunk of employers out there who might qualify for the ERC. Well, here's the problem that hadn't been addressed before. What happens if you acquire somebody? Let's say, you know, you're out there, you're acquiring another CPA firm, your client's acquiring another restaurant. I mean, you know, there may be some pickup opportunities here, right? If you have the money, you know, to bail somebody out, pick something up, and then you've got this location that you didn't expect to get. So I assume some of that's going to happen. But what happens if we acquire an employer now, so we have our acquisition, and that employer took out a PPP loan? Now, I already mentioned there's a complication if that loan's not been paid off or forgiven in getting the approval of the SBA and the bank in all of this. And so remember that we discussed a few weeks ago, but let's talk about this thing. What happens if we do it? Well, they look at two different cases. First, they look at the case of what happens if you acquire, right, the equity of that previous employer, right? And, you know, we have this involved. And what they do is they break it into two categories. So we went out, we got all the stock of the company, right? We got the equity. So we got the entire, it was an S corp, we got all the stock. It was, you know, it was a partnership and we bought all the partnership interest. So we got 100% of the equity. And probably more in the corporate standing, because we're looking at this now continuing as a separate entity. But it's now going to be part of our aggregate group. And the ruling comes down to this. If this other related company now had already paid off its PPP loan before we acquired them, then as part of the aggregated group, we actually can go ahead. And first thing is, we definitely can still claim the ERC on our employees, you know, that were in the target ahead of time. But also, this kind of nicely provides that you even, in this case, can pick up the pick up the amount involved, right? For the employees of the company you just acquired could qualify for ERC if they otherwise meet the requirements. So again, you picked it up, the loan was gone. You can treat that as never having had a loan once you take over. But the flip side of that is, what if it's not fully satisfied, or I should say it's fully satisfied, or they've applied for forgiveness and they establish the escrow account the SBA talked about. That'll also get you the ability where we can count it for everybody. But let's go to the flip side of this. Either the loan is not fully satisfied and there's been no escrow to pay it off. Remember, the escrow would pay it off if we're not, whatever is disallowed, there'd be money there that could pay off. So we haven't done that either, which I suspect in a lot of cases there won't be an escrow. And so we don't yet have forgiveness in hand. In that case, still fine for the acquiring company, but now the employees of the target, we are not going to be able to claim any ERC credit for employees of the target employer if that loan was not paid off or we had not gotten forgiveness before the deal closed. So be aware of that. The IRS says that's how it would work. Then we go back and look at a second case. Well, what happens if, you know, we acquire the assets of the employer instead of acquiring the equity? So I go out there and, you know, I acquire all their equipment. I acquire the rights to their leases. You know, I acquire, but it's a pure asset deal, which quite often we prefer to pick up an asset deal, not inheriting potential liabilities from the old corporation. Well, if that happens, then we're back to another two questions. If we do not, the buyer of the assets, if we do not assume the PPP loan, so in essence, regardless of whether it's paid off or not, obviously if it's paid off, we won't assume it. If it's been forgiven, we won't assume it. So let's say it's not been paid off. So either it's been paid off or it's not been paid off, but the old owners keep the liability for the loan and have to make it work. If we don't assume it, then again, we can claim not only the ERC on our employees, but also on the acquired company's employees. We can get the ERC on that. If, however, we assume the loan, right, as part of the deal, we take over that debt, which we are going to hopefully be able to get forgiven, right, by basing it on both what we pay and what was paid by the predecessor. If we take that over, then we cannot claim the credit on the, cannot claim the credit on the employees that are that previously worked for the target company. Right, we're going to lose it there. So basically, if you have that situation, take a look at this. These questions were added to the standard IRS FAQ for the employee retention credit. Now, again, reminder, I will be talking to the New Jersey Society of CPAs on November the 30th, and we'll be talking about the PPP loan forgiveness program, where we stand now in the program. It'll go over again the actual where we're at now. So there will be some new information from what we had the last time I gave the program for New Jersey, which was in early September. So we've come two, and at that point, close to 3 months down the line. So we'll talk about what's changed. We'll still talk about the basic process. So if you're not aware of how the process works, we'll be talking about that in that too. But want to emphasize some of the new things that have come out over the 3 months. So we'll be talking about that way. If you want to sign up for that, you can sign up at the New Jersey Society of CPAs website. It will, as you might expect, be a webcast, and it will be a four-hour session that will take place. So we'll be there on that date. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November the 23rd, 2020. Again, you can email me, Ed Zollers at CurrentFederalTaxDevelopments.com, if you have any questions or comments on the program. You want to follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ed Zollers. If you are a member of the Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, or Washington Society of CPAs, I do monitor the Connect programs, Connect sites on those state societies. And I may jump in if there's a question that arises I think it'd be helpful on. So you can take a look there on those societies. Otherwise, as I say, we've got another week. One good news is actually this week may be very calm. We'll cross our fingers. It is the Thanksgiving week, so IRS may not turn out a lot of stuff in this week. We'll see what comes down. We'll talk about what's there. We've already had a couple of things come down. that I'll probably be writing up, and we'll see what else comes down. But it probably will be calm unless they just want to hide something, and then it would come out late on Wednesday. So we'll talk about next week, whatever happens, even if it's not much. We'll also keep an eye out for anything else happening. Congress is now out of town, so we do not expect to see any congressional action. I doubt they're going to come back this week regardless, even if they somehow came to a deal on a new COVID relief bill, or they somehow come with an extension paying the government. My guess is that that'll all come together the following week at the earliest. So anyway, check back in with us next week. We'll be here following up on whatever happens in current federal tax developments for the end of November.